Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to another Hobcast book show. And it's getting a little bit dreek because it started to rain on us.
I know, just as we started.
Yeah, we're sat outside the most wonderful coffee bar, the Burr Coffee House in Stirling.
I think we've patronised this place quite a lot, haven't we?
We have. We have spent a few bob here. And it is Sunday morning as the Bloody Scotland Festival effectively feels like it's winding down. One or two of the authors I've seen packing their cars and heading off. But we've had a wonderful time here at Bloody Scotland. It's been fantastic. Again, similar to Harrogate, a great affirmation of what we're doing in publishing. Great to spend some time with contemporaries and an opportunity to get rained on.
Well, we've loved it so much. We've even flirted with the idea of living here, haven't we, a little bit?
Well, yeah, we did for Harrogate too, to be fair. But welcome to the programme. And just if you're new to the Hobcast, you might want to know who we are and what it is. Well, I'm Adrian Hobart.
I'm Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hoback Books, and we are UK independent publishers of the following genres.
Thrillers.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
Not bad. Crime. Right, that was our rather mixed efforts at Scottish accents.
Yeah, it's one of the accents I cannot do. I mean, I'm not very good at accents anyway, but Scottish I find the most troublesome because I'm rubbish at rolling my R's.
Yeah, a complete arse. Right, no, it's been fantastic. I love the Scottish accent, especially when they say murder. There's been a murder. And we were at a session yesterday with Mark Billingham and Chris Brookmeyer.
Who has got a wonderful accent, hasn't he?
He does. He does have a really fantastic Scottish accent. And he said murder about six or seven times during his talk.
We should have counted it, shouldn't we?
Oh, I wish. I wish I'd recorded it. In fact, we did have one stage. We didn't have the guts to do it, but we thought it might be nice to go around recording people saying murder around Stirling. But, you know, we chickened out.
We should have done it at night time when they've all had a drink or two and they'd be more willing to do it.
Listen, we've got a very exciting guest for you. Tina Baker, author of Call Me Mummy, which has been to number one in the Kindle charts. It's just had its paperback release. Tina is something of a media star. She has spent many years reviewing the soaps on programmes like GMTV and Five Live, and indeed, you know, I used to share the same building with her, but I never had the guts to come and speak to her.
And I used to watch her reviewing the soaps while I was doing my revision for university exams and things like that, so, you know, I was a bit starstruck as well, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And last night she had an opportunity to pitch her book, Call Me Mummy, to the audience in the Albert Halls here in Stirling, and she dressed as a bumblebee, as you would, because the name of the session she was preceding was called The Killer Bees with Mark Billingham and Chris Brookmore.
So it did make sense, because she said to us, oh, people probably wondered why I was dressed as a bee, and I thought, well, it was The Killer Bees.
Yeah.
Now, it made sense to me.
Yeah, look, she's a force of nature and quite wonderful and incredibly honest about where her book came from, that her three main characters, all of them flawed, all of them, you know, slightly warped, are parts of her own personality. But you'll hear all that a little bit later in the programme. Listen, we haven't really looked at news this week, have we? Have we got much news to talk about?
No. What's been in the news? Well, it's been difficult to keep up with the news, I think, because we were so busy cramming in as much as we could in 3 days in the week, and then we came up here. So,
yeah, I don't think I've really followed much publishing news. So I'll tell you what, for 1 week, we're going to give that a rest.
Okay.
And let's reflect instead on what we've experienced here
at
Bloody Scotland. Now, it's been a big deal for the organisers. And on the first night we got here, I bumped into Bob McDevitt, who was a guest of ours, say, 10 episodes ago.
Mm.
And he was hurtling between the assembly rooms and back to the main hotel, the Golden Lion, where some of the other sessions were being held. And I said, how's it going? He said, well, it hasn't started yet. And he looked energised, a little worried, because, let's be honest, when we spoke to him, off the record, he was saying, I'm not entirely sure the festival can go ahead because the funding wasn't in place.
Yeah.
But they got the funding and they got it going. And it's not been as busy on location.
No. But partly because they've had the online, so the hybrid festival, as they call it.
Yes, so they did an online, there's been an online offer, and in fact, you know, some of the sessions which we didn't attend, we will catch up on.
Yeah.
Online, because people have been raving about how good the one on forensics was, for instance.
Mm.
And that was hosted by our good friend Chris Merritt, who we spoke to last night.
Who just walked past, actually.
You did, yeah. Chris was one of our earliest guests on the Hopcast. So he really is doing great. He's got a new book out, which I must go and look up the title. I did promise I'd mention it on the podcast, so we'll look that up.
We'll mention it after the interview.
Absolutely. But that was a great session. And there have been a lot of very, very useful informational sort of sessions for the author community, really.
I think we were talking about this last night, weren't we, that our sort of overall impression of Bloody Scotland as a festival, it's a very deep thinking festival. Mm. So, yes, it's an opportunity to get together with other writers and the readers and all the people who keep the industry going, you know, the bloggers and the publishers. But it's also a chance to sort of think about crime writing and think about Scottish crime writing and think about you know, the sort of the philosophies behind it, which I've loved that.
Yeah. Well, you may remember when we were in Harrogate, we spoke to Ian Rankin about how he'd taken the discovered notes and a few scenes from William McIlvany and created The Dark Remains, which is a collaboration with the late William McIlvany and Ian Rankin. And just, it's come home to us here. I mean, we learned a lot from speaking to the man himself, Ian, about how he'd done this, taking a few notes and trying to enter the voice of someone else. But just how important everyone within the Scottish crime writing community feels William McIlvany is in terms of the social conscience side of his writing, the fact that it was able to use it to expose the problems of Glasgow in the 1970s through crime. And that thread goes through a lot of the crime writing that's still being written. And you think of Val McDermid's 1979, Winter of Discontent. She's got a protagonist who's a journalist like she was at that time. And again, opportunity to explore Scottish society, the different strata of Scottish society through the prism of crime.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this with Mark Whiteman to some extent when we interviewed him for the podcast, that you're writing fiction, but you're also writing about society and history and culture as well. So people are learning as well as being entertained in quote marks, you know. And Scottish crime writing is very much like that, possibly more than English crime writing, I think.
And I think certainly to some extent more than American crime writing too.
But oh,
I think,
yeah.
But I think British crime writing is a much more defined genre, a much stronger and bigger selling genre in this country. I mean, it is the dominant genre in British publishing.
Yeah.
Without question, you know, far more so than romance, whereas romance dominates everything in America, and certainly on online sales, that's where the money is. Fantasy comes a close second, and then you know, you've got the big guys. So it's yeah, the festival definitely has had a depth to it that I think Harrogate had a feeling of, hallelujah, we're all getting together again.
Yeah, because it was the first one for a long time, wasn't it? And so everybody was almost sort of so enthusiastic and so happy and catching up with each other, as opposed to sort of reflecting, whereas here it's a bit more, a lot of these people were at Harrogate, they saw each other 2 or 3 months
ago. Yeah, they're
ago.
Over that bit.
And so now they're thinking more and discussing more, and I really like that, because that's what, to me, what a festival's about. It's about getting a bit deeper. And also been inspired to read other things. You know, between us, I think we've bought 6 new books to read.
At least. Probably about 10, I think. But yeah, we've had an opportunity to hear people talk about their books. And what I like about Bloody Scotland is the before every major session, someone, an unknown author or debut author, comes forward and gets a chance to read some of their book and just have that little bit of exposure. And I bought a couple of books just on the basis of that. And I think that is so valuable that they've done that. And it's been a tradition here. As they approach next year, will be their 10th anniversary. But you do feel that if they hadn't held it this year, then it would have been really potentially the end of Bloody Scotland as a festival.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, and it's a good opportunity for those people because they may have never been on the stage before.
These new
writers, and so maybe next year they might be on a panel or a year after, or yeah, I think that's a great event for them.
The highlight. What's been the highlight so far for you? I mean, out of the festival.
Oh, the highlight.
Apart from the curry on the first night.
Well, I mean, Stephen King last night was amazing. Although, should I confess this?
Go on, confess.
Okay, so
confess.
There was, the Stephen King session was 2 people on a Zoom-like screen speaking live from America. And for the first 20 minutes, the guy on the left to me looked more like he was Stephen King than the guy on the right. And then about 20 minutes in, I realised I got them the wrong way around. And Stephen King was actually the guy on the right.
Yeah, so the other one was Linwood Barclay with tons of Jay Leno-like hair.
And then I felt really embarrassed because I did Google and I thought, that is so Stephen King.
And Stephen King's the slightly crumpled older man.
So, although I was embarrassed, I did confess to you that I'd spent the first 20 minutes thinking the way.
It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun for me. The pick was, without question, the Killer Bees. So Chris Brookmeyer and Mark Billingham going through all the 1-star reviews they've had on Amazon and also the direct emails they get when they've been slagged off by their readers, which was really encouraging because I know that a number of our authors get the odd 1-star review and it crushes their world.
Mm.
But actually, it's much healthier if you just laugh it off, which they did brilliantly.
Yeah, they did, and it almost it made it so comical that it actually made me want to read the books
to see
why these people were picking on these tiny things, elements of criticism.
So these are million booksellers, authors, and best-selling authors who still get 1-star reviews.
Yeah,
from their loyal fans who say, "Oh, you know, but you've lost me on this one."
They were almost hurt by it, weren't they? They were saying, I've read all of your books, absolutely loved them, and then you deliver this to me.
Yeah.
Like it was personal vendetta.
Absolutely. Listen, let's get to the interview. Let's talk to Tina Baker. And her debut novel has just come up. It's called Call Me Mummy. You cannot miss it if it's on a book stand anywhere. It's now in Tesco and Asda, she tells us.
Yeah, so
black cover,
easy to find.
Pink dress. And it looks like it's a chick lit book, but it isn't.
Yeah.
It is very much, it's dark. It's about a woman with no children who steals a child from a Woolworths or something similar, from some convenience store.
Mm.
And the warped world that she lives in, and also the impact on the mother who loses the child, who's, you know, a working class mother who's struggling with, different fathers for each kid. And the impact on her, and also it's seen from the perspective of the little girl, Tonya, who is potty mouthed, let's be perfectly honest. And I will say this, I'm not going to edit this out, there is a strong use of language towards the end of the interview.
Yes.
But in context, we're going to keep...
But it's authentic.
It's authentic, we're keeping it in. So unapologetically, in full glory, in Technicolor, the wonderful Tina Baker. Tina Baker. Can I just say, this is actually a bucket list moment for me.
Because, oh, shut up.
No, because I spent many years trying to pluck up the courage to say hello when we used to be in the same building, and I never did.
That is the most bizarre thing. I don't think I'm at all scary. Why? Are you mad?
No, I was just chicken. I mean, you know, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? You can work in the industry, in the broadcast industry, and yet there's an awful lot of us who... put on the performance, do the extrovert thing, and then have to retreat and rebuild the energy because we're actually introverted.
Shy,
yeah.
Absolutely. Nobody who's not done telly or radio would quite understand how I can be such a gobby cow and then actually do the hide in my bedroom. I wouldn't come out of my bedroom unless I've got three layers of makeup on, like yourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've got your makeup on today.
Yes.
I've got three days of fuzz. That's my...
Me too. Yeah. Postmenopausal fuzz. Not you, me.
But look, it's a great honour to
honour. Shut up.
I know.
He's been so excited about that.
I have.
Been excited about that. I loved the fact that, you know, we got like this shared Radio 5. Mm. Whenever I went into Radio 5, because it was sport and different, I used to feel like a complete imposter because I used to do the soaps. I was the soap queen. And I've come up to bloody Scotland and I feel like an imposter because I'm not Scottish, although I do know Lorraine Kelly, so they let me in. And I feel like I've written a book and I'm not good enough. And I do my Keep Fit classes and I feel I'm not good enough. So it's like the imposter syndrome. Oh, you know, we've all got it. It's like, I just make myself do stuff anyway.
Yeah, I think that's it, though, isn't it?
The imposter syndrome never goes away, then. Because you've got bags of experience, haven't you? You know,
you're calling me old? Yes, I am. I'm vintage, thank you. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't go away.
That's what because, Stephen King said yesterday.
Yeah, it's like it doesn't. And I feel nervous and anxious and depressed when I am not going out at all, because I shielded. And I feel nervous and very anxious when I came out to not just my first Bloody Scotland festival, but my first festival, my first literary event where, you know, the next minute you're sitting next to Mark Billingham and my knees are knocking. Mm. I did actually have to dress as a bee for that session. I know you saw it. And the reason I dressed as a bee is because I'm now not only in my first festival, but I'm talking about something that's like really dark. It's like, oh, I've not been able to be a mum. And I would either go on stage and cry when I read from my book, or I would dress as a bee because it was the killer bees session.
It was, yeah.
And I thought, I can be a silly bee. And it's like putting drag on. Mm. You know, so I put my makeup on. I sometimes get dressed up. I sometimes get dressed down. And do that as a way of dealing with my anxiety. So that's a full story about people thinking, who's that mad woman on the stage dressed as a bee and why? There's no bees in the book. There isn't.
No.
But it worked, though. It really did work, I feel so. Because, you know, you had that sort of very light-hearted but deep at the same time. At the beginning, you as a bee reading an extract from your book that was, you know, very thought-provoking. And then the two comedy blokes later.
I didn't realise how comedy they were. They had picked the perfect session for me, didn't they, really?
Yeah. Mm, you know, they did.
Chris Brookmyre and Mark Billingham. And it's like, and then I'd also thought ahead to the book signing that I'm like Billy Nomates, the debut author. And like when I spotted Call Me Mummy across the room where Waterstones actually had it, that's only about the third or fourth time I'd seen it in the wild, because there is a Waterstones on my road in London, the Crouch End thing, and I have battered down their doors since lockdown. So when you come out in lockdown, it doesn't feel real. If you're a debut in lockdown, even more so. So on the way up, I went into WH Smith at King's Cross and cried and sat on the floor for a selfie, and somebody took pity on me and bought a book. Then I got to Edinburgh and they got one copy left. So I rushed to it. You know, I can spot my book in a whole lineup. You know, it's the black cover and the pink dress. And it's like...
So if it ever commits a crime.
Yes, exactly. and then coming up here, I just assumed that nothing would happen. And then I saw my books. And it's like, you know, I squeak. I won't squeak now because only bats and dogs can hear me when
bees.
I squeak. And bees. And then the most bizarre thing was I walked out of the rehearsal at the Albert Halls and saw the Extinction Rebellion Stirling doing a Save the Insect protest.
We saw that yesterday, yes. Didn't we? Yeah,
so,
they were dressed as butterflies, weren't they?
Well, I was dressed as a bee and I joined in.
Brilliant.
And literally two policemen came up to us in the middle of the Extinction Rebellion. So we were just in the precinct in Stirling. And I just thought, well, it's meant to be.
Meant to be.
And free the bees, free bees. All of the puns came out. And the Extinction Rebellion people were a bit bemused, but they were delighted I turned up. And I just thought, this is before my first festival. I might be arrested here and now.
That would make a great story,
though,
wouldn't it?
And I'm here to sort of do my reading, you know, my first reading in the...
They'd be waiting for you on the stage. Where's the bee? The bee's in prison.
The bee's in prison for the protest. But it wasn't a protest. It was just saying, save the bees by not... doing, you know, letting your garden grow a bit wild and don't use pesticides. I thought it was the most benign Extinction Rebellion ever.
Oh, it really was.
It was so pretty.
But what, can I just correct you? Up here it's the police, isn't it?
I'm sorry, it is the police. I've been to the police session at Bloody Scotland, so I should know better.
I find it funny. I mean, you know, I've cracked up every time Chris Brookmeyer used the word mother.
Yes.
About six times. And
I love murder.
And I loved it when, I mean, going back to
Lorraine,
who appeared on something recently where she had to say, there's been a murder. It's absolutely, I was just on the floor. I don't know what it is about the Scots saying murder. It's just
the Taggart thing, isn't
quite,
it?
I love the Scots accent anyway, so it's quite sexy, I think.
Yeah, it makes murder sound quite nice.
Yeah, it does. It makes you want to join
it's
in.
A burr, yeah. Well, we've all joined in, at least in the pages.
So, Call Me Mummy, your debut book came out in pandemic, which is most unfortunate. But having said that, it's making ripples. It's really doing well. It's in Tesco's, I saw.
Yeah, it's in Tesco's and Asda. Tesco's is a big thing for me because me and my family cleaned the floors of Tesco's for many years. And were treated very badly by some of the people who wheeled their dirty trolley wheels over the bit that you'd just done and sneered at us as if there was something they'd stepped in. So to get my book on the shelves was fantastic. I've not seen it because I went down my local Tesco superstore and it wasn't there because they stopped doing books. So, but most Tesco superstores and Asdas have got it and WH Smith. So that's a buzz for me. It's like, that for me is like winning the book because it's like to see it in the supermarket. I'd never bought a hardback till I became an author. You know, I'd never done it. I did libraries as a kid. I've always done paperbacks. I mean, we got to number one on Kindle and I don't read much on Kindle because I'm so old school. I'm so old fashioned. But you know that, I mean, that was thanks to Lorraine really, because we'd worked for many years together on GMTV. I'd done the soaps there. And I'd got a quote from Lorraine and a quote from Eddie Mayer because that's where me and you'd worked on Five Live. And it makes such a difference, I think, if you've got a champion.
It does.
You know, Stephen King gives a quote to somebody and, like, people, I'd buy that.
Yeah, it does make a massive difference. I mean, that's part of what we want as publishers, isn't it? Is if we can get an endorsement from somebody.
Yeah.
Particularly if they're well-known in that genre or if they're the sort of people that people relate to and think, well, she reads that, she's read that and loved it, then I'm probably going to love it.
Yeah, it's so all the little things that you find. So I am, like, so grateful for that. And it still doesn't feel real. That's the thing. I think if you've wanted something as long as I've wanted it, it still doesn't. Not just coming out in the pandemic, I don't think. But I was shielding and I am anxious. And, you know, my mental health is always dodgy at the best of times. So I was like whimpering, you know, curled fetal on the sofa being colonised by various cats. And then you don't want to get up when a cat's sort of on bits of you, do you? You think, no. Oh, no. So I die of deep vein thrombosis rather than move and disturb the cats.
Yeah, I've been there.
Despite there is what trigger warning. There is a cat in the book. Call Me Mummy, the mummy of the title, is a deeply unhinged woman, sadly partly based on my own dear mother, God rest her soul, who was abused by Welsh nuns. So there's a little twist on the theme. And so she genuinely thinks she's saving somebody, you know, sort of takes her Catholicism to the nth degree. And I think any religion that's fanatical is dangerous. So it's different, I think, from most child abduction stories. It was me thinking, I've wanted to take a child that I've seen somebody shouting at in the shops. I have. I've not. I hasten to add, I have not. But what happens if I had indulged that dark impulse? Because I've been desperate. Also, when we went through, like, the IVF and that, you're pumped full of hormones.
Yeah.
And I'm a bit mental anyway, so, you know, plus the,
and
you
they,
know.
They do send you a little loopy.
The mega hormones. And I just sort of be crazed by it. And then think, because I'm from Leicestershire originally, Madeleine McCann's story, what if those parents had been working class? Because they were crucified in the press. And if they'd been, like the woman who loses the child in my book, working class and a little bit dodgy, she's branded scummy mummy by the press. And that's my years of journalism. You know, the handy headline that you are labelled, it's like the Scarlet Letter. And I'm all those people. I am mummy in my most deranged moments. I am Kim, the woman who loses the child because she smokes, she drinks, she's got tattoos and she swears. I no longer drink, I no longer smoke, but my tattoos are permanent and I still swear when I'm not on air. And there's something about the profanities in the book, again, that the reviews have been really good, apart from the one-star review because the packaging from Amazon was damaged. Thanks, mate. But mostly it's been good. And the criticisms have been mainly because it's a woman using the vernacular. It's a woman swearing. And it's like, yeah, that's the character. They're the people I grew up with.
Yeah.
And it's real life.
And it's real life. But, you know, if you're Irving Welsh, you can get away with it. But if you're a woman, it's frowned upon.
Yeah, still.
Still.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
I think you captured that. Brilliantly. I think, you know, I must admit, I'm not quite through the book yet, but the characterisation, it fizzes. Your dialogue, that sense of reality around the sort of people you do. I mean, I lived in Bognor Regis for a bit with the BBC. I had to, worked in Chichester. And the sort of Kims of the world would shop in the Safeway.
Yeah.
And what they would do is they let their kids sit in the sweet section, open the packets, scoff as many as they could while they went and got the shopping, and then left the empty packets, and it was effectively in-your-face shoplifting.
But even like ordinary people who don't do that, you can't win as a mother, you can't win as a woman. You're either, you know, you stay at home mum and you judge for that, or you go out to work and you judge for that.
Absolutely.
And yes, I don't know as if I'd have been a better parent. That's the honest truth. Mm. And also, I was like the kid in the book who's stolen, not the perfect daughter. So I had a very troubled relationship with my own mum. But that was partly on me because I was a bolshy little so-and-so. So I really identify with a little girl in there who she, you know, a lot of mums, I think, have got this idea of we're going to dress her up like a princess. That child and me was not a princess. You know, if they dressed me up like a princess, I was a real tomboy. I'd run around like a mad thing. I was totally feral.
That's funny.
I'm still a bit feral.
That's exactly the same as me. My mum was always saying to me, why don't you wear pretty clothes? She still says it to me.
But it's like, I love the girly clothes, but I write dark. So I'm full of pink, you know, My Little Pony vibes, but I write like a 6-foot goth from Sweden, you know. So it's like, but that those bits of dark humour keep me going. It's like bits of, you know, gallows humour or newsroom humour, just that's exactly what you need, isn't it, in the darkest of situations.
That's how you cope with dark situations, though, isn't it? You have to laugh at something.
Oh God, yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's interesting you say that about the gallows humour, because this is one of the things, I mean, we were talking about earlier about how I fell out of the BBC, was that the gallows humour that I grew up with, because I was a news journalist before I became a sports one, you know, used to go to terrible things. You see terrible things, you meet, you know, people who perpetrated terrible things, and the only way to get through it was to, like the police do, you know, is to laugh about it. But you can't do that anymore. And I mean, you know, that's you know, within a certain generation of people, just don't expect older people generation to speak like that, or to have that attitude.
And I think it's like some people take swearing as aggressive. And I used to be aggressive, I'll be honest. I've been aggressive in drink, but I'm not an aggressive person. And often it's said from a place of real love and affection. And if you're from the North or the Midlands and a working class background, you take the piss out of people you like.
All the time. That's what it's like, yeah.
And now I should apologise for using that phrase.
No, don't. Don't. I've said much worse on this programme.
But that's the truth. It's like if I'm unedited, if I am my authentic self, I think like that. Mm. Me and my husband talk like that. He's from, you know, Cornwall, and he's from, you know, sort of working class background. And it's like we found each other. And what we say at home, I edit myself in my Keep Fit classes that I do as a day job when I'm not writing. And I've got to a stage now, I'm frightened of editing myself on the page, but I've done a deal that I will throw everything at it, heart and soul. And some of it's edited out, some of it's advised to be edited out, but it's from a place of trying to be authentic as I can. And as a woman writer, it's like, why can't I use Irving Welsh language? Why can't I use the bad jokes? That's how people like that. I'm not Kim, I'm not Mummy, I'm not even Tonya, but they're parts of me.
It's a different aspect.
I wanted to be as honest as possible and as open as possible and talk about anything as well. So, you know, no more lies, no more pretending to be normal, no more, you know, self-editing. And I think that's what you have to do. So the book is my heart, my soul, my psyche, my dark bits. It's like literally washing my dirty linen in public. I would not have been able to write that book if my mum and dad were alive. Seriously,
oh,
you know,
I can imagine,
it sort of gave me permission for them dying to sort of just go out there, just go for it.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, because you were immersed in the world of soaps for a very long time. And
loved them, still do. Oh, don't watch them. Oh, revelation. Literally, I can't watch them anymore because too much going on in my own brain.
Yeah. But you juggled all those storylines, and I mean, I used to watch in awe, if I'm honest, when you're on GMTV.
Me too, when I was revising.
Yeah, yeah. No, and the way that you, I mean, the passion you brought to the excitement of what's going to happen tonight in Emmerdale or wherever it might be was great.
But genuinely, I watch them all the time. I love them. And we go to the briefing meetings because I work for TV Times. I know the storylines in advance. I'm actually, even though I blab everything about my own life, I'm really good at keeping secrets. So, you know, I know. Yeah. And even if they said, oh, they, you know, they'd film two endings, they'd film 6 weeks after so you can work it out. You know what I mean? So I'd always know. But I loved it, and I loved Lorraine. I still do love Lorraine. You know, she's been a great supporter, and that team. So I wasn't faking it, and it felt like a bereavement giving them up. Mm. So telly gave me up, really. Radio gave me up. And it was like, you know, my age is like, do what you really want, do what you really love. Mm. Because there's no money in writing as far as I can work out, but write from the heart. Mm. And I knew I couldn't do my storylines and then be across all the soaps.
Yes, yes.
So that's been the biggest thing I gave up to be a writer, my biggest sacrifice.
But I wonder whether that has, you know, that exposure to the churn of the soaps, the structuring of the soaps, the storytelling, has rubbed off in your writing.
I don't know. I mean, I hope so. You know, it would be a compliment if it had. The one thing I'm passionate about is the characters and making them real. Mm. And the soaps are one of the few dramas, particularly on the BBC, where you get working class people. Mm. Not anymore quite so much, because I think there's more representation now. But when I started, like literally 30 odd years ago, it's like, you know, EastEnders were the only people who were like people I recognised. Mm. And it's the same in novels. You know, I'm a voracious reader, always have been, partly because my mum didn't really learn to read or write very well, because they tied her hand behind her back because she was left-handed in the convent, as well as abusing her, because it was a sign of the devil.
Yes, it is supposed to be, it was supposed to be.
Literally. So
I can see that.
right, I'm sorry, there's domestic now.
When's your, who do you share your birthday with again?
Damien from The Omen. I was born the same day, the same year in the film.
I love that. But God bless her.
We're both devils, I think.
So abused by nuns, not really well educated because she was from the fairground. So my grandma and granddad ran a coconut shy. So she didn't have very good schooling, and she thought it was really important. My dad, similarly, he was a window cleaner who played double bass in a band at night, got a scholarship to grammar school, couldn't go because his mum was a widow and he had to get a job. So they both loved education. So there were books from the library. Mm. And also I was sort of, they were both working two jobs. I was left on my own quite a bit. And, you know,
so
it's
what
just
do you do? Read.
Read. Mm. And I had a very eclectic reading, so Wind in the Willows and The Virgin Soldiers.
Wow.
Literally, you know, so I had access to everything. I've read a lot of stuff that you shouldn't read at that age.
Yeah, I did too.
I didn't understand.
Lots of Jackie Collins.
didn't understand half of it, what was going on. The carpetbaggers, what does that mean? Look it up in a dictionary. Oh, really? Even didn't understand the words in the dictionary, so I think that's coloured it as well as the soaps.
I actually don't know what carpetbaggers are.
The carpetbaggers was a 70s novel, I think.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was about, but I know there was sex in it.
Oh, yes. But I think it's really interesting. Something like, I'm trying to think of his name, John York, who used to write.
I adore John York. Yeah. I adore him. So he's now an academic.
Yes, exactly.
He came to, I did go back to school and do an MA in creative writing at City, where I'd done my postgrad for journalism, because there was a discount, because I'd done a degree earlier. And he's wonderful, and he is, you know, passionate about storytelling.
Yes.
And has actually analysed it. Mm. I mean, I couldn't do it analytically, I have to do it instinctively. Mm. I'm an emotional writer, I don't plan or plot. It's a bit of a mishmash, and that's scary, because Call Me Mummy's out now in paperback and I'm promoting that. When I get back home, I've got to do the proof edit on the second one, which is coming out next year. Nasty Little Cuts, you have to be very careful how you say that. And then they wanted a synopsis, you bad publishers, on a third one I've not even written yet. I don't know.
I never asked
synopsis.
A synopsis. In fact, one of our authors said, she said, I've written the book, would you like me to write a synopsis? I said, no, I want to just read it. Just send me the manuscript. I just want to read it.
To be fair, my editor is about to go on maternity leave in literally weeks and hasn't got time.
Okay.
You know, to read whole books. So there is one written which, you know, I did a synopsis for, and there's one I'm writing which it wasn't exactly a synopsis. What might happen? I don't know. It's in my brain, but it's not out there yet.
Just send a blank sheet, and then when they say, but it's blank, oh, whoops, sorry.
I sent the wrong thing. But my brain's a bit shredded by that. I think the shielding and the lockdown did it a bit for me, and because I'm anxious anyway, and the brain fog. I mean, who knows? I don't think I've had COVID, but I'm still super cautious. Get your vaccines. But it's hard, because it's also they become your book babies, and not having children. Mm. I am ridiculously emotional about it, and the only way I can talk about it, you know, when I'm talking about it, is do it almost like in a media way. Mm. And almost make fun of myself, and that is the saving grace. So if I can make a complete tit of myself by literally running around the stage dressed as a bee for my very first book reading, I can do that, because I needed to use the energy. And I found out literally in the wings of the Albert Halls that you can't do star jumps when dressed as an inflatable bee, because I usually do star jumps before going on, you know, to use up adrenaline. So being a Keep Fit instructor is quite useful for me, because I'm quite high energy most of the time with huge vicious slumps.
I love your life story in terms of how you became a fitness instructor, going on
Celebrity Fit Club. With Julie Goodyear, there's a soap name, who became my surrogate mum.
Bette Lynch.
Bette Lynch is my surrogate mum. She actually signs her Christmas cards to me, mum. God bless her. Again, this is somebody who's been had a bit of bad press, I think. You know, they've made her out to be this queen of the soaps. She is a bloody queen of the soaps, actually. Give her the respect.
Yeah, yeah.
But she was on there. And, of course, you're hungry. You're tired, because they make you get up at 7 and do press-ups. I spent most of the time in tears because my mum had just died. And even though, you know, it was a very ruptured relationship and she once tried to stab me, I loved her because she was the only one I got, and I get emotional thinking about that, so I'm not going to go there. But it's like Andy Fordham's just died, God bless him, the darts player.
Yeah.
I loved him. When you go through something like that, it's like going through a boot camp, literally. It's like I bonded with all those people.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I felt like without a layer of skin. So I understand the trolling I talk about in the book, that, you know, the pylons. People were saying, oh, look at her jazzing, look at her crying, you know, she's faking it. And I just wanted to say, my mum's just died, give me a break.
Mm.
Book Twitter is not like that, I hasten to add.
No,
that
book
has
Twitter's
kept
lovely.
Me through. Yeah. It has saved my life, probably, and I'm not exaggerating, in the darkest days of shielding and anxiety and working with anti-vaxxers. It's just like, oh, dear God. Give, you know, please be kind, just be kind. Mm. I've gone off piece. What were we talking about?
No, I mean, I,
that, oh, yeah, celebrity fix.
Well, the way, yeah. the way that that became, you know, it was a total revelation for you, wasn't it? In the sense
yeah.
that process that you went through, the amount of weight you lost. And
I mean, it was only like 2.5 stone on the programme, 3 stone now. I put on 0.5 stone back. Funnily enough, not in lockdown when I went back to work because I was so scared. Mm. But still, I'm at the weight now that I was sort of at the
but
end
then to
of
get
fit
become a, be you know to take up do the training yeah. and get qualified.
I am passionate about that because Harvey, who was you know, so I got fit with Harvey, who was literally a military trainer. Mm. So you were doing star jumps at 7 in the morning, and his mantra is keep it going.
Yeah.
And it really helps with writing. So I throughout lockdown did a stretch at your desk free sessions for older people and writers, you know, throughout the whole thing on the Zooms. God bless Zoom, because you're sitting in it for so long and often talking and writing about things that are quite painful. So to move the body, if it's a walk or a stretch or just get up and, you know, walk around, it's, again, that's something that's helped my mental health as much as my physical health.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's, you know, and I feel a bit evangelical about that. You can't make people do it. So my husband is overweight and smokes and, you know, doesn't listen to me at all. My brother recently lost half of his body weight. So he was morbidly obese for all of his adult life. Mm. Over 30 stone. We don't know exactly how much because we couldn't get him on a scale. He retired and less stress. He's now lost 12.5 stone. Bless him.
Oh, good for him.
And, you know, so it can happen. You're never too old to do that. Mm. And I wobble still because there's no surprise. It was when my mum died, I lost the weight. Because it's, you know, emotional eating. Mm. You know, emotional eating. It's the less glamorous addiction. Mm. You know, drink, drugs, they've got... I've been to so many Al-Anon meetings and NA meetings and stuff like that, you know, with for myself and various other people. You know, relationships I've been in. Being addicted to other people. You know, I've got to have, you know, my relationship. But food is looked down on.
Absolutely.
Slimming World is the most underrated, you know, support group, I think.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true.
Yeah, I've attempted Slimming World a few times, but I've never been able to stick at anything. I mean, that's been the story of my life,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, because you always feel better when you start a new regime and you go for walks and then go back to do some work, or you go and play golf
yeah.
and you go mm-hmm. do some work. But it's... Then you have a crisis, don't you?
Yes, and then I've had crises and you put back on weight, yeah.
Or
you've
suddenly got too much work, you don't make time for the exercise, and then you just get out of the rhythm
again. It's a slow suicide, I always think of it. Any addiction is like, you know, I've tried fast suicide, you know. I failed at that as well. So, you know, it's that sort of thing. And I say it lightly because I see a fellow traveller. And for anybody listening, it's like I talk light because I am dark. Mm. I'm a nice person, but there are real wounds, real big, horrible, gaping wounds. And some of that's in the book, but some of the niceness and the humour's in the books as well.
But I think that's what readers want. They want the authentic voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, they want to, you know, they want to learn something about you and they want to you know...
Yeah.
Learn about people and read about real people. They don't just want it to be sugar-coated or to be happy.
Do you know what winds me up? Netflix. I know it's kept me alive, Netflix, but all those American dramas, it's like, you don't have a house like that if you do a job like that.
Yeah.
You know, it enrages me, the glossy. It's like, what, she's supposed to be having a breakdown, but look at her hair. I remember doing interviews with the soap stars in America and they thought EastEnders was a documentary because nobody would look as rough as Pauline Fowler. Seriously, this is not a joke. Because when they were having, you know, brain surgery, they'd still have a full slap on. That's not real life.
It reminds me, my mum was training to, not midwife, what comes next? Health visitor. She's trained to be a health visitor and her tutor said to her, watch EastEnders.
Really?
To get a sort of what life is like, can be like, you know, saying EastEnders is almost documentary.
What, like going to visit Lou Beale?
Yeah.
But it's true. And that's, I mean, God bless the soaps. And I hope there's enough in my books that feel real, because people say, oh, did you do any research? It's like, but it's inside my mind. It's inside my heart. You know, I've gone through this. Yeah. No, I've obviously not stolen a child. I keep reiterating that. I haven't. But, you know, I know enough about the... I mean, the second one's about murder-suicide. I've not done that either, but it's always fascinated me. I can definitely know what it feels like to want to kill yourself, but why would you take everything with you? I wouldn't harm a whisker on my cat's heads. You know, that's the thing that fascinates me. And it's also based on, I've been married 3 times, engaged 7 times. I've got a lot of bad relationship history that I can draw on. You know, so it's like I didn't really need to do very much research on that either.
Mm-hmm. And you worked with Kelvin McKenzie, so...
I did.
So you know every swear word there is, you know.
I knew more. Well, my dad was a window cleaner. I knew more. He was a bit like Derek and Clive for the older listeners. Yes, Derek and Clive, every other word was an F or a C. And me and my brother's favourite game as a kid when my dad was on the phone was I'd count the C's and he'd count the F's. And we topped them up. Brilliant. That was our brilliant game.
I love that.
When I was working on BBC Breakfast... on the sports side of things, they invited Gordon Ramsay to come and review the day's football. So the editor of the programme decided that, for some bizarre reason, he was a rather timid editor. He's now the editor of the 10 o'clock news. But he said to me, go and see Mr Ramsay.
And tell him not to swear.
Exactly.
Did he tell you to fuck off?
He did. So I went into the green room. Moira Stewart sitting on the end of the...
Of course she is, Dame Maura.
And there's Gordon Ramsay and Billy Bragg's in as well.
Oh, brilliant mix.
What a mix.
Anyway.
To listen on my conversation.
Well, I mean, you can imagine. I said, Mr. Ramsay, appreciate you coming in. I'm Adrian. I'm producing the sports section this morning. My editor has asked me to remind you that it is a family show and refrain from swearing, please. Anyway, what the F?
Yeah.
You get me in here at this time of the... Yeah, Monday morning, yeah. You know, you effing gnats pizzle is what he called me. And then Billy Bragg.
Oh, I love it. Moira, did he join in?
I don't like to say Moira went a folly colour, but she did sort of, her expression was priceless. And then Billy Bragg's going, yeah, right, fourth of bloody estate and all this stuff, you know. You tell him, Gordon.
Oh, I love it. Are you watching Ted Lasso? I think it's on Disney Plus. Because they've got a sweary pundit on that.
Yeah, and then it goes. Then Gordon goes, only joking. Of course, yeah, no problem. I'll be professional.
Yeah, you do learn how not to. And I'm very aware now that I have, so I apologise. So it's just like trigger warnings, isn't it? I think as long as you know, there is vernacular in my books, but it's from the heart. It's not done just for the sake of it.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I was a terribly sweary person in the newsroom, and
but not on air.
Yeah, not on air.
Yeah,
but as an editor,
all newsrooms are surely.
Well, you'd think so, but it's culturally now not allowed. I mean, we had a colleague, and I guess you would have worked with him at some point, but I don't want to talk about it in too much detail, but he was rusticated out of the BBC and put on front of the newspapers for being, you know, for want of a better word, a sex pest, or accusations came forward and they threw him under the bus because someone else within the BBC was more famous, was facing those allegations, so they gave him up and his career ended. And after that moment, this is a few years ago, and he was one of my direct colleagues and one of my people I had to manage. Basically, the place became a library. No one spoke, no one joked, no one felt comfortable.
They were too scared to.
Yeah, and actually, I would try and break up that sort of silence, but I think it got me into trouble.
Yeah, it's. I think now it's that talking about self-editing when you're writing stuff like that. It's not conscious. Some of it. Some of it is like, you know, I sort of stand by all the language I've used, but I am very aware of it now. You can't not be aware of it, can you? That's the honest truth. But the soaps manage without swearing, so there is that. You're talking about the grittiest thing.
Yeah.
Brookside did swearing for the first week or so. Can you
remember?
One of my favourite soaps.
Yeah.
You know, and it was the most authentic. But then even that, you know, the things that happen.
The closest thing is flipping, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've got to be flipping joking. You know,
but a very good accent.
When Danny Dyer's saying, "You're having a flipping laugh."
It just doesn't ring true.
Does it?
And given what they're talking about, the issues.
Yeah.
So I think it's a fine line, but also people are grown ups, and it's your particularly readers. I think everybody reads in their own voice.
They do.
And just know that, you know, it's there to try and be real. And it's like, if you would know how many swear words I've edited out, because people are saying, well, you know, and each layer it goes through, you know, this edit, that edit, the other edit. It's a bit disconcerting, really, because it makes me, I live with shame a lot, having been brought up Catholic. So I always feel ashamed. I always feel like, oh, you know, I'm the world's worst writer in some ways. And then, you know, when people like it, you just think, oh, hallelujah.
Love it.
You know what I mean?
I'm very conscious of time. Looking at this big clock up on the above a statue of William Wallace, and I know that you've got to move on to something else. So I'm going to ask one more serious question, and then we've got to get the Rebecca random question.
Okay.
And just really wanted to reflect on your experience of coming to a book festival here in Stirling, and how's it been?
I've been shaking a lot. I have loved this. I love talking to you. You were the only people, apart from Marion Todd, who I sort of knew, because Marion and me did a Zoom panel, and she's been wonderful. And people have been quite nice, but I still feel like the new kid at school. So I don't know. I went to bed at 9:30 last night because I just crashed and burned. And I feel I failed festival life at that. But also, you know, I am older than a lot of the writers and I need my rest.
Nothing wrong with that.
But I did, I wouldn't say enjoy the going on stage, but I'm really glad I did it. It's one of the bravest things I've ever done. And I've jumped out of an aeroplane. It's that level. It
Blimey.
Felt like that. I mean, I had a parachute and everything, but, you know. But it felt like that. It felt like that exposing. But this is a woman who took her clothes off to publicise the second book. You didn't see anything. It was very Calendar Girls in the best possible taste. Because it's that level of, like, being naked emotionally.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor, isn't it? So I have loved it, and I'm a bit reeling still.
It's our second festival, so I know what you mean, because we were completely at sea at Paragon.
And I still feel that. And we went to bed early the first night. We watched MasterChef and fell asleep, so...
I watched a bit of Strictly last night.
Oh, we did,
like,
we did. We got
a tiny weeny bit, yeah.
I love the gay pairings. Yay!
So is it time for my round?
It is time. Okay, I'll give it a build-up.
I'm looking forward to the round.
Okay, we haven't done a jingle for this yet, but we will do...
Random questions!
There you are. Rebecca's random question.
Do you own lucky pants?
Oh, now this is a bit of a revelation. I'm not wearing any at the moment, and I very rarely wear them because I'm always in Lycra. So I've got my leggings on, and I don't wear knickers with my leggings.
Well, that was an unexpected answer.
I don't. So I very rarely wear knickers. But, you know, I'm perfectly decent.
Yeah, yeah. But
wow.
Have you ever owned any lucky pants? You know, or a lucky token or a lucky something when you're doing...
When I'm trying to cop off.
yeah.
Because I've been with my husband for 20 years, I have to answer this very carefully. My lucky pants variation was 10 pints or about 5 doubles. But if I did that now, I'd be in hospital having my stomach pumped because I've not drank now. It was after Fit Club for about 13 years. So not only coming to my first festival sober. And that's another reason I went to bed, because throughout lockdown, I've really felt the thirst upon me of, like, it would be so much easier in some ways. But then you'd found me in the gutter and I wouldn't have been able to speak this morning. And, you know, I would have tried to mount Chris Brookmeyer or something. You know what I mean?
Well, we've all done that.
We all want to.
But, you know, don't they rock that sort of, hey, cool vibe?
Yeah,
the cool guys,
do.
Mark Billingham, Chris Brookmeyer.
They do.
I sat next to them. Yeah, I would have probably mounted Either one, both, with a few gins inside me, so I'm glad I don't drink anymore.
That would have made a very different festival.
It would.
Tina Baker, thank you so much. And
thank you.
It's a wonderful book. Good luck with Nasty Little Cats.
Call me money, please buy it so I can afford the cat's bills.
In your local Tesco.
In my local Waterstones.
And no, it's been another life affirming conversation. Yeah, we get definitely. these with this podcast, but thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, the wonderful Tina Baker. If you are offended by that word, tough. Read the book. You'll have a lot more of them. Trust me. It's a great book. And as I say, it's been my bucket list to meet Tina Baker because I used to love watching her.
I think we're still a bit starstruck, even though it's half an hour
but
now.
But she's the one who said she was starstruck because we're the Hobarts.
Apparently. I know. You're the Hobart family, the dynasty.
The dynasty. We've been publishing for a year and a half. That's hardly a dynasty.
Yeah, the irony is that my surname's Collins, so I should be the publishing dynasty.
Yeah, you should be. You should be. Right. Before we move on, I had one more piece of information, and the new book by Chris Merritt, which I promised I'd mention, is The New Home, which is a psychological thriller, which is kind of right because he is a psychologist, so his publisher's twisted his arm.
Yeah, they did. They said, write what you know, and he did.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Good on him. Good on him.
Yeah, I look forward to reading that.
Right, let's get some wider perspectives on how bloody Scotland has been for people.
Yes, we've stumbled across two people.
Donna Morfitt, of course, who is... has been on the show not so long ago and came up and Suze
Clark Morris
wonderful. Suze Clark Morris, well Suze, let's start with you. What did you think of Bloody Scotland this year?
I am so grateful to be back. I'm so glad we're here. It's smaller, it's a little bit different, but we're here and I hadn't realised how much I missed it. I'm a regular. This is my fifth year maybe.
Right.
So I'm a regular. I come for the whole weekend and just live every moment, and that's what I've done this weekend.
It's our first. Is it your first, Donna?
Yep, my first as well.
So let's ask you, I mean, as a first timer, what did you think?
Obviously I've been to Harrogate, so it's completely different to that, but not in a bad way. I think Harrogate was all condensed into one beer tent and one place, whereas this you're sort of spread over two locations, but it's been awesome. I've loved every second of it, and I definitely will come back.
I think it's got a fantastic sort of literary feel to the place.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, this is the 10th year of Bloody Scotland as well, so Stirling embraces it every single year, and in normal times we do a torch lit down the street from the castle, and you know the Provost, the Lord Mayor, Lady Mayor comes and speaks at the prize giving. They absolutely embrace the festival.
Oh, that's fantastic. Maybe next year they might reintroduce that.
When we have the Hobfest, what are we going to do?
The Hobfest. We're probably just going to have a cup of tea and a crumpet, aren't we?
Oh. Got something visually spectacular. Burning cats. I don't know.
No.
So you've been here when it's been busier?
Yes. Yes. And normally there's three venues as well. There's a smaller one again. So there's always three options. There's so much to choose from. As there was this time, there were still hard choices to make. The fact it's gone online as well is fabulous because so many people who can't be here for whatever reason have now got access to everything. I think everything's gone online, and there's been some online exclusive stuff. So this hybrid model, I think, will perhaps stay from
Yeah, I think Bob McDermott said the same thing, didn't he? So now they've tried it.
Yeah. But nothing beats being here and seeing authors. And I haven't got my selfies this year. I don't think that's appropriate thing to do yet. But I've got my book signed. I've talked to people. I've had coffee with people. I've drunk in the bar with people.
And your favourite session's been?
My favourite session was the Pitch Black Humour yesterday with Doug Johnston, J.D. Kirk and Antti Tuomainen.
How about you, Donna?
I wish we'd seen that.
I mean, you've got Stephen King, obviously, but I think the Fun Loving Crime Writers on Friday night was just absolutely awesome. They're nuts, but it was such a great time. Yeah. It really was fun.
And we went to bed early.
We watched MasterChef and went to bed. But we regretted it, though. We regretted it.
Catch it online. Catch everything you've not seen online.
Yeah, that's definitely in the plan, yeah.
Yes.
And
likewise,
if we come back next year.
10 days, I think. 10 days the pass goes for.
Right.
Till the 30th.
Okay.
So anybody that's not been here or has been here and has the digital pass, you've got access till the 30th.
Mm. And in your judgment, I mean, the Scottish crime writing scene is phenomenal. And it is the driving force of the British one, let's be honest. The arguably the best writers in the genre are from Scotland. They're the patrons and they've been driving forces behind this festival and supported it. I'm thinking of Val, I'm thinking of Ian Rankin. It is a phenomenon, isn't it? Scottish crime writing.
It is. And I think, I don't know, I think it's probably the bad weather. I think there's this dark... There's a darkness, I think, to Scottish people. I think they would agree with that. But there's also there's a black humour that runs through it as well.
Yeah.
But it is. It's you're absolutely right. It's a phenomenon. And whilst this is a really big festival, we actually have several. There's Aberdeen Noir. There's Butte Noir. There's something in Inverness, I think. There's a tiny one in Cromarty in the Black Isle, which because Ian Rankin started several years. I'm heading to that one next year. But that's a tiny, tiny one. So they're all over the place, and I was talking to Donna about there's so many English authors that I've not read yet, not deliberately, it's just there are so many good writers, and we are really lucky up here with the amount that we have.
Yeah, and I think it's also something, and we've noticed this, and we've sort of been thinking, should we move here, because
yeah, it only takes 2 days and we want to move here.
I think this is not, I don't want to denigrate, because I'm English through and through, but I don't want to denigrate the English, but you just can have, even in a restaurant or whatever, casually, a really intelligent conversation with anybody you meet, it seems. And I don't think you get that necessarily in England as much.
No, I think people here, I've lived here 26 years in Glasgow, so only half an hour away. And I think the people here, I think probably the north of England is very similar as well, but they are so welcoming that you can talk to anybody, and such interesting folk. I would move back now. Although it's quite cold and often wet. But it's so beautiful.
Yeah,
well.
It is. It's
so beautiful.
And I actually don't mind the cold and wet myself, so I'm sold.
You'll find the scenery plays a large part in Scottish crime writing as well, because we've got so many places that are perfect for burying bodies and isolated crimes. So
perhaps I need Donna to defend the English flag now. What do you think?
I'm with you. I'm coming up here. It's too nice. And like you say, you go anywhere, and the camaraderie as well between all the authors, and you know, they're just, everyone's so happy to be back together anyway, but it's just been amazing. The atmosphere of everyone together has just been amazing, and yeah, it is stunningly beautiful up here, and yeah, I'm with you.
I was going to say that really. I think the biggest cheerleaders for Scottish authors are other Scottish writers.
Yes.
It is a hugely supportive community.
I'd like to think the English one is as well, but I do get the feeling that the authors here, it's just about, look, get the words on the page, polish them up and get the book out, as opposed to there's a lot of, mystique and mystery that is around the English publishing scene, you know, the sort of the gatekeepers that you saw perhaps at Harrogate. A lot of them on the Thursday night were there for the award, and they were sort of surrounding their authors and keeping them away from the public. You don't get that up here.
No, they are so accessible and so happy to talk to you. And I've collared people for signings as they've been checking out of hotels and you know, on the way to the loo, walking past the pub. they are fabulous, and nothing's too much bother. And as Donna says, they're also grateful to be back here. Normally we would have a football match here as well. There's a Scottish crime writers versus the English ones. There's normally a football match with a pop-up gin stand. So hopefully we'll be back
Fantastic.
To normal next year with the torchlight, the football.
I think we've got to come again next year.
Well, if they need a goalie, I was an under 10 goalie, so I'll do that for them. By then I might be published, so I can legitimately play.
There's an incentive for you. Get your book written.
Yeah.
And can I play football? Yeah. It's when we play it up the hill at the Church of the Holy Rood, there's a grass area there. I think it's the old hospital grounds or something. And we play up there.
I'm glad there's a church nearby, because I'm probably going to need it after that. You know, so
we play.
Yeah, we can bring forward the funeral a bit.
On that optimistic note.
Yeah, come back.
Drink, and die.
Come back and just enjoy, and it's the best festival I go to. It's the highlight of my year. And come back and drink Bloody Scotland cocktails next year.
Yeah, I didn't this time.
No, we didn't. We just stuck to the gin.
Yeah.
Well, it's gin based.
Oh, okay.
So you're right.
Well, jolly good, jolly good. Donna, for you, highlight.
You said Stephen King.
Just being here, you know, just being and meeting Suze. I've not met her before, so that was awesome. And yes, meeting different authors, Sharon Bearden as well. I've not met her before, so yeah, just meeting people I've not met and being around and being, I just love it. I love every second of it.
Are you going to get post-festival blues when you go home?
Yes, absolutely, no question.
Yeah, I'm sure we will too.
Oh, I will. I'll be really miserable tonight, I warn you.
Great. And I've got to put this podcast together at the same time while you're looking miserable at me. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Glad you
Thank
enjoyed
you.
It.
Thank you very much.
So it's really time to call time on this edition of the Hobcast.
It is, yeah. And we're probably going home very soon too.
Yeah, we are. We're going to wind our way down the long and winding road.
Yes, and stop at about 10 service stations on the way.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, we're going to stop at T-Bay again, aren't we?
Yes.
And load up on extremely expensive charcuterie. And
he loves that place.
I do. I can't help it. That's when the middle class Englishman in me comes out, and I have to stop and buy a load of expensive rubbish as my phone goes. Anyway, it's my son.
I know, I can see James Hobart.
Well, I'll call him back in a minute. Anyway, it's been great to be here at Bloody Scotland and to bring Hobeck Books here. You never know what spins out of this. If you think about it, we've had submissions from people who saw us 2.5 years ago at Morecambe and Vice.
Yeah, you
so
never
maybe
know.
In 2.5 years' time, someone here,
such as Donna Morfitt, you never know,
or Stephen King himself, said, "I saw you at Stirling, and I'm going to submit to you for the next."
I don't think Stephen King saw us.
No,
he was,
but he felt our presence.
He felt our presence,
yes. Of the room. So it has been an absolute pleasure. Rebecca, thank you very much.
Adrian, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hobcast Book Show. Don't forget, we have we have a load of episodes. We've got 35 previous episodes to listen to.
This is 36?
This is number 36, I believe. So please take an interest in those. We've got some great upcoming books, and we'll be talking to our soon-to-be-published authors very, very soon. Who's next on our list?
Oh, next would be Harry Fisher.
Yeah, Harry Fisher, another Scottish author, very, very soon. And we are busy publishing a lot of titles. So if you want to know about what we're doing, www.hobeck.net is the place to go. But from this edition of the podcast, and from me, Adrian Hobart.
Murder. Oh, I can't do it. I still can't do it.
Murder.
Murder.
That's pretty awful. What's your name?
Rebecca Collins.
Rebecca Collins.
Rebecca Collins.
Rabbi Collins.
I need to live here so I can master the accent.
You're going to have to. Jesus, you sound like a sore thumb. Anyway, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you. As ever, we wish you a wonderful, creative week.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.